Good morning. There is a common assumption within a great deal, if not the majority, of the literature on theological education. And that a common assumption is that character formation and spiritual formation are one thing, that require one set of activities, and that academic study and professional formation is another thing and requires another set of activities. And consequently, that academic study, the work that happens in the classroom, the library, and the research center, that this is not spiritual formation. That's academic formation. If you want to do spiritual formation, if you want to do soul formation, you go elsewhere. You go to the chapel, to the retreat center, to the small group where we discuss the spiritual life. The implicit assumption is that academic study is not soul forming. And indeed, there are some, and for those of us with the revivalist heritage, it's not uncommon to discover that there are some who actually think that academics is actually a problem for soul formation. It actually is pitted against the formation and the development of the individual person's spiritual development or priorities. That there's a battle between academics and soul formation. As a notable aside, I reference also the EEAA survey that was taken and that was referenced in the last newsletter and that Graham made reference to yesterday, where schools, yourselves, were asked to rank three objectives: academic growth, spiritual development, and ministry skills. And I wondered, as I read that, is there an implicit assumption here that academics is for academic growth and then other activities are for spiritual growth? If so, this is a common assumption, both for academics and for pastoral skill development, that these are not soul formation. Whether this is the intent of the survey or not, and I suspect it's not the intent, it is nevertheless a common assumption to separate these two agenda. But is this an accurate and helpful way to speak? Can we, should we not, sisters and brothers, speak of academics as itself spiritual formation, as good for the soul? I don't hear an amen, but I'll keep going. No, there we go. I want to stress, I fully concur. And this evening, in my lecture this evening, I'm going to speak of the crucial place of worship within academic communities. I fully concur that we need complementary activities to the classroom, activities that are typically called spiritual formation. I believe that central to the theological community, to the Bible college, the seminary, the theological school, is its worship, that it's pivotal to be a worshiping community. I also believe strongly in the value of guided prayer, of small group conversation, of mentoring, and so on. Indeed, the value of the retreat center. I lead directed retreats. It's a vital part of the ministry that God has given to me. But I want to challenge the assumption and insist that we need to speak of guided prayer, small group conversation, the chapel, and worship in a way that does not discount the formative value of the academic process and experience itself. My proposal is this: that we can and must affirm that the classroom and the other typical activities that enable good learning, including study in the library, that these are good for the soul, and that indeed they are vital to spiritual growth and nurture, as vital as the chapel, as guided prayer, as small group conversation. I want to speak this morning to the transforming value of formal theological education, indeed to speak of the classroom as an essential element of a spiritual formation. For what it's worth, I think that's what I'm doing now. I'm doing soul formation in this hour with you. I'm urging us to appreciate that the academic process, even such things as this four walls, all of you sitting facing me, one person talking through the mic, that this has redemptive value. If it doesn't, why bother? I'm urging us to think of the academic process and of the community, the academic community, as an academic community, to see it as having the capacity to form and reform and transform the human soul. First, in this regard, we need to speak of the academic process as the necessary complement to those activities that we typically speak of as spiritual formation, namely guided prayer, spiritual direction, counseling, and chapel services. We can and must insist that prayer and study are complementary and that they are necessary to each other. that we come to our studies as prayers, and that we go to our prayers as students. That worship is complemented and informed by teaching, just as teaching is informed and complemented by prayer and worship. That our study and our research, that the scholarly task of careful attention to one dimension of understanding, can and must, to the Christian, be deeply informed and shaped by our experience of God in prayer. That we come to our work as academics, as those who are in intimate communion with Christ. That we go from the celebration of the Lord's Supper to the library. And that our experience at the table establishes the contours of our work with the books. Oh, that our students would not see prayer and worship as in any way a competition for the time they need for their studies. To the contrary, their prayers and the worship of the community anchor their lives in Christ, in an orientation towards the reign of Christ. And it settles their hearts away from anxiety and fear, and infuses their imagination with an awareness of the glory and majesty and wonder of God. And this, if it doesn't shape their studies, what's it doing? Indeed, as a doctoral student, it was my regular practice to pass by the chapel for a few minutes on my way to the library. Not because I felt a one-to-one connection between if I go to the chapel first, that somehow then my time in the library will, I could just feel the force of having been to the chapel. But it was my way of declaring to myself, it was a symbolic act as much as anything, of my way to declaring to myself that anything I did in the library, I did as one who was first in prayer. Our work as students, scholars, and teachers needs to be anchored by prayer. We study as prayers. As such, then, our communal prayers, our common worship, enable the whole of our work as an academic community to be shaped by the common experience of the risen and ascended Christ. Students who skip chapel because they are too busy with academics, or faculty who do not see chapel worship as integral to their work as scholars, simply fail to see and appreciate what it means to be a Christian scholar in a Christian academic community. But the reverse is also true. Just as prayer informs our study informs our prayers. I would pass by the chapel on the way to the library, but then after my work in the library, I always came to the chapel again before I headed home, because I wanted to signify that my worship in the chapel is informed by my identity and my work as a scholar, student, and teacher. I will speak to this more this evening when I speak about the ordering of the affections and the crucial role of liturgy and worship in that. But for now, to stress the following, that true worship is grounded in understanding and in a consistent and thorough theological vision. Worship must be grounded in a biblical vision of the triune God in the work of Christ and God's work in the world, a biblical vision of the reign of Christ. The great challenge of evangelical churches in my country, in Canada, is that worship is simply no longer informed by biblical theology. It is entirely oriented towards feelings, affections. In fact, we just quite simply say, how do we know? We sing a song, we sing it so often. How do we know that God is in this place? Well, you can feel it all around you. And that's it. That just somehow defines that this is authentic worship. And our liturgists or our worship planners simply choose their songs with one criteria and one criteria alone. It is not a theological vision. It is entirely a sentimental one. Will people feel good when all is said and done? The massive achievement of the hymnology of England in the 18th century is the union of heart and mind in the linking of exquisitely theologically nuanced lyrics with appropriate musical scores. I witnessed to the greatness of Charles Wesley and Isaac Watts, but now we have come to define worship as purely that which feels good and seemingly sustains a predefined emotional tenor, without asking the hard question, but what does this song mean theologically? I think we have the same problem with pastoral care and spiritual direction, that our pragmatics has asked the question, what works? And so many students who want to provide pastoral care and spiritual direction do not realize that they are but partners in the work of Christ, and that as shepherds of souls, they need to have a theology of the Spirit's work. It's their pneumatology that will shape their practice. And this means that pastoral studies must be deeply informed by a theology of the Spirit. I could say the same about evangelism and mission, by the way, and congregational leadership. It needs to be rooted in a biblical theology of mission, of evangelism, of the nature of the church, and so on. My main point, though, is this here, that the two are complementary. That our worship and practices of soul formation are complementary to the academic enterprise. Study and academics is informed by the chapel. And the chapel worship infuses the whole curriculum such that our studies are informed by an experience of the gospel, the encounter with Christ, and that conversely, our worship in the chapel flows directly out of our critical engagement with biblical theology in the classroom. However, I'm going to go further. I'm going to insist not only that they are complementary, but that academics is also itself soul formation. That both are essential for soul formation, but that both are in themselves soul formation. Perhaps you're thinking, well, that's fine, but only if we reform teaching and learning, only if we make the classroom truly a place and an event, a space for soul formation and transformation. Perhaps. But this is not achieved by making them less academic or less demanding intellectually. To the contrary, my appeal and my point is this, that the actual process of teaching and learning, that the actual process of the academic disciplines that sustain the life of the mind are an essential element of soul formation. This is doubly so when the classroom is complemented by worship, guided prayer, doubly so. We must affirm the place of worship and guided prayer as complements to study in academics. But my point is that the classroom in its own right is as much a place of soul formation as the chapel is. This is so, in part, because no religious heritage, other than the Judeo-Christian one, places such a huge priority on the life of the mind. Oh, that we would understand how crucial it is to develop a Christian mind and to pursue understanding that is grounded in the truth, in consistent and biblical theological convictions. Transformation requires understanding, and understanding requires processes of study, learning, reflection, conversation that are precisely the objective of the academic enterprise. Good doctrine matters. The formation of a worldview, Christian worldview, matters. We are not converted, as Paul Hebert put it so eloquently, until and unless we are converted in our minds. I think also of Leslie Newbegin in The Conversion of the Mind, of seeing reality and of understanding as both the ancient faith and in the character of Christ's kingdom. Jesus came teaching, and in so doing, he took seriously the mind of each of his hearers. Taking the mind seriously means that we take the transforming power of the truth seriously. However, our evangelical and revivalist heritage is deeply ambivalent, at best, regarding the mind and scholarship and study. As my former colleague, but now retired, Gordon Fee at Regent College used to put it, he says, "I'm a Pentecostal scholar," which, of course, is an oxymoron. He pointed out that in his scholarly communities, when he would introduce himself as a Pentecostal, they would immediately wonder whether he could be an authentic scholar because he's a Pentecostal. And he says that's tragic. But the greater tragedy is the reverse. Can I be a true Pentecostal if I'm a scholar? And that, for him, makes him deeply anxious, in a sense, for his own evangelical heritage. Do we believe that it's possible to be a devout scholar? And do we believe that the work of scholarship might actually sustain, nurture the spiritual life of the individual and of the community? What we have to contend with is what Mark Knoll has so brilliantly and eloquently stated, or described it as, the scandal of the evangelical mind. We need to call it what it is. He's given it the right word. It's a scandal. It's scandalous because it is not consistent with biblical theology and with our evangelical heritage, actually, when you go back to the early forms. But, as he points out, it was not long. Jonathan Edwards was the exception. I wanted him to say that John Wesley was one as well, but I'm afraid he didn't. Jonathan Edwards was the exception. And he, in his recent history, he's only published the first volume, his History of Evangelicalism, he documents our unease with the mind, our ambivalence about the mind. If we take the mind seriously, it means that we take the discipline of the mind seriously. Academics at its best is hugely beneficial discipline. Simone Weil has this wonderful reflection in one of her essays published in Waiting for God, where she reflects on study and on the love of God. And she notes this, that warmth of heart is not a substitute for something essential to true prayer, namely attentiveness, by which she means focus, clarity of focus, wherein our whole beings are given up, over to, and caught up in another reality, in this case, the reality of God. And that the great gift of our studies, she suggests, is precisely that it cultivates this attentiveness, this capacity, that our studies all nurture this orientation towards God. And so she ends this essay with this extraordinary statement. Academic work is one of those fields containing a pearl so precious that it's worth to sell all of our possessions to keep nothing for ourselves in order to acquire it. My son studies at Regent College. I was full-time there. If he had studied then, when I was full-time at Regent College, his tuition would be free. Unfortunately, I'm now only part-time on the faculty. Actually, he studied at two schools. His undergraduate studies were done at a school where I used to be the dean before I went to Regent. And so during his undergraduate studies, he had to pay full tuition. And now he's at Regent. And he says, Dad, you left too early. Now I have to pay full tuition. And he's paying $15,000 a year. $15,000 Canadian, which, by the way, is more than $15,000 American. Just kind of to register that. And he bemoans this with me every day, all the time. He's just saying, can you believe, Dad, I'm paying this much money for this education? And I quote him, Simone Weil, oh, son, it's nothing. $15,000. He designs websites. Like, this is nothing to him, in my opinion. I mean, that's big money, designing websites. But I say, son, it's nothing compared to the pearl you're going to get. The opportunity, not what happens outside of the classroom. He's paying the $15,000, the $15,000 precisely for what happens in the classroom. And I tell him, it's worth every penny. Transformation comes through the renewal of the mind. And the mind needs discipline, focus, and clarity. The mind needs to be worked hard. There is no substitute for the process of guided reflection where the student, through persistence and perhaps even frustration, comes to see and understand something of the mystery of the Trinity. And no one can do this for her. She needs to take time on her own to move from the classroom to the library to her own desk, back to the classroom, back to the library, perhaps to the chapel to express dismay and frustration with God, and then back to the classroom again. Nobody else can do this for you. No one. She'll have conversation with her professor, perhaps, and with fellow students, but it will only ultimately dawn in her own mind. And as the mystery of the Trinity and the wonder of the two natures of Christ, or the meaning of the cross, or the nature of the church start to form in her own mind, she is a different person. Her faith has substance, meaning, and focus. This is spiritual formation. And it's not merely the academic work of reflection on the Trinity. It is also, as Simone Weil pointed out, her comments were made with regard to the study of languages. It is also the persistent and daily diligence of study of Greek and Hebrew and Latin. Indeed, Micah, my son, is privileged to take his Hebrew from David Dewart. And I think to myself, you're in the company of a man who walks close to God, and it will be apparent in the study of Hebrew. What a gift to you. There is deep value in these disciplines in themselves, but also in their capacity to order, bring clarity, bring focus to our thinking, and thus to our souls. The classroom is a process of deliberation and focus, and it does not appeal to instant or immediate gratification. We're not trying to entertain you. It is not about feeling good. It's not about getting quick results. It's about diligence, about an acquired taste for the deep things of the soul. It is about perseverance. It is about focus. It is about moving slowly and seeking with passion, discipline, and diligence to know the truth which will set us free. We should think of the classroom through the image of Proverbs chapter 4. If you seek it with diligence, you will find it. Day in and day out, it takes time. It takes diligence. It takes patience. Go to the library, I say as frequently to my students as I will say to them, go to your prayer chambers. And then also it means that not only if we take the mind seriously, do we take the discipline of the mind seriously, it also then necessarily means that we take teaching seriously. The call to teach is at the very heart of biblical piety and spirituality. The extraordinary passion that Jesus had for teaching is reflected in his commission to his disciples to teach the nations. And this is reflected in St. Paul's obvious call to both preaching and teaching. And then the words of the pastoral epistles where Timothy is exhorted to teach sound doctrine in season and out of season. And all of this, I think, is but a reflection of the wonderful image of Nehemiah chapter 8, where we read where the people heard the words of the Torah explained to them, and they responded with great joy because they understood that this indeed is joy. It is transformation. It's a false notion then. I heard it 2 weeks ago at a consultation in Bangkok, where indeed one of the presenters at the consultation insisted that all we need is faculty who are full of the Spirit, not faculty with degrees. But I asked, but what are they teaching in the fullness of the Spirit? I want to say it's a false dichotomy. It's a false polarization. And if we take teaching seriously, if we take the mind seriously, we'll take the discipline of the mind seriously. And if we take the discipline of the mind seriously, we take teaching seriously. And if we take teaching seriously, we take scholarship seriously. And here is the key. You see now where I was going. What this all means is that scholarship is not a threat, but an essential dimension to the piety and worship of the church. The scholars within our communities are gifts to the church. They are the teachers of the church. They're the huge and extraordinary resource. And part of why I'm touched by being in this room with you is that you are representatives of the schools that house this extraordinary jewel, this gift to the church, her teachers. And all of us can remember courses that have had an extraordinary impact on our lives. At breakfast this morning with my neighbor, we both took Psalms from Bruce Waltke. And neither of us has ever been the same. Well, is it because Waltke was preaching the Psalms? Is it because Waltke was praying the Psalms? Well, he could have been preaching or praying them, but he was teaching the Psalms. His actual teaching method left much to be desired. But we are deeply shaped and informed by the extraordinary wonder of a man who walked us through the Psalms. And the hour would come to an end and he would say, our time is up. And there was every one of us was saying, let's do another Psalm. We'll skip coffee in order to walk through another Psalm with you. It was teaching. I think of the man that taught me church history, Albert Kramer, and his extraordinary capacity to give us the big picture, to teach us humility as we study church history, to see that as we look forward best if we look back as far as we can, to use the language of Winston Churchill, to give to us the extraordinary gift of the individuals who are now my teachers. He introduced me to Origen and Bernard of Clairvaux and Julian of Norwich and Luther and Calvin and Wesley. That these become my continuing teachers, and he introduced me to the ongoing witness of the church to spiritual wisdom. I think of Robert Weber, who died 6 months ago. And I remember the course that I took on him with him on the theology of the early church. And as he was lecturing on Irenaeus and the doctrine of recapitulation, the idea that Christ is the second Adam, I can picture the moment as it suddenly dawned on me then that Christ is the head of a new humanity, and wonder of wonders, I'm a part of this new humanity. This happened not in the chapel, it happened in the classroom. There's been a valuable conversation over the last 20 or 25 years that has probed this question. Can the classroom, and indeed must not the classroom, form us for wisdom? Can theological education be formation for wisdom? The primary, or I would say the lead voice in this regard, is Edward Farley. And dear friends and colleagues, I just think this is an invaluable voice. David Kelsey as well, but Edward Farley, partly because he started a conversation that has just been an invaluable one for those of us who give leadership to theological schools. In many ways, he launched this discussion in his book, Theologia. But many have picked up the theme and urged that we think of theological education through this lens. He suggests this, Farley does, that wisdom is a cognitive disposition. It's sapiential knowledge, to know God so that we are growing in wisdom. That we can think of scholarly reflection that is oriented to the particulars of life and work. And we study so that we can live and work with grace and integrity and joy. That our engagement with theology is an engagement with theology that enables life, so that the study of theology becomes indispensable to our capacity to live and to work. What I am struck by is that this same principle applies. I lecture probably about every 6 weeks. I'm in some forum where I'm lecturing business people. I'm giving a talk to those who are called into business and commerce. I think of myself as trilingual. I move between the academic world, the world of the church, two different languages, and the world of the corporate world, the work of people within business. And what I am struck by is this huge, palpable desire. It's a palpable longing for a theology that will inform the life and work of those who are in the corporate world. That is, they want to be wise in what it means to be a business person. And essentially, that's the same thing that Farley is talking about. And theology does this. It grants us the gift of discernment, to enable effective judgments, to make decisions that are grounded in the life-giving truth. Theology that enables us to act appropriately in real-life circumstances. How does the study of theology form us in wisdom? Well, it does so when it begins with faith. Faith informs our study, our research. It's faith seeking understanding. But it's not just our own individual personal faith. It is also, as Robert Weber would put it, the faith of the church. Our creedal and spiritual heritage anchors our studies. Furthermore, it is formation and wisdom when the scriptures become the grand narrative that shapes our vision of the world. When the scriptures become the indispensable canon and anchor for our growth and wisdom. When our study of the church becomes an exercise in standing on the shoulders of giants, learning wisdom by attending to the voices that have preceded us, not biblicism, in other words. When we learn to read and exegete culture so that we understand how our ancient faith wars against the deep values and mores of the cultures of which we are a part. And when we practice what we learn. When these things happen, we are apprenticed in the faith, apprenticed in the study of the scriptures. And Linda Connell aptly puts it or describes the process this way, that the qualities required and shaped in this apprenticeship are reliable reasoning, intellectual and spiritual virtue, and humility. Or, I ask Linda, why didn't you add this word? Wisdom. The result is not merely knowledge, but wisdom, wherein knowledge is woven together with a vision and a practice of life in the world. And if this vision of forming people as wise people is going to be the vision of theological education, then we're going to have to learn from earlier generations of Christian theologians, educators, and scholars. We need to learn from Bernard of Clairvaux, for whom there is no dichotomy between heart and mind. We're going to have to learn from the Brethren of the Common Life and the Imitation of Christ and Thomas a Kempis, to which it's attributed, where there's this incredible interplay between study and our celebration of the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper. That is, we need to learn from previous generations that did not see reason and spirituality as in tension with one another, but as necessary to one another. My focus here in these comments has been, by way of illustration, the scriptures, the study of the scriptures, the study of the faith or the theology, church history, and the study of the biblical languages. But I think much the same could be said of the courses that foster the practices of ministry, whether it's teaching, learning, preaching, liturgics, or worship leadership or pastoral care. I should say this, that in making these comments right now, I'm not distinguishing between academics and practical courses. I think that also is a false distinction. I try to emphasize in all the three schools where I served as a dean that pastoral ministry courses are and must be just as academic as scripture and theology courses. It's just that their orientation is different. But these courses can also be, they can also be courses that are soul formation, because they empower us and they enable us towards vocational holiness. They enable us to be mentored in the practices by which we fulfill our very calling and grow in spiritual maturity, because we grow in our capacity for vocational integrity. But also because we learn by doing. That if doing does not inform understanding, understanding will not grow. If doing does not inform understanding, understanding will not grow. We do not grow in the faith unless we engage the kingdom work of God. And what the practices or the courses in practical ministry essentially enable us to do is to engage what it means to live and act in a way that is consistent with the inbreaking of the reign of Christ. And also, our courses in practical ministry must be enabling us to work with others, to appreciate the gifts and abilities of others, to exercise our own gifts and abilities in a way that is cultivated or strengthened by mutual dependence. And indeed, if our courses in practical ministry aren't teaching us to work with others, well, then we're missing a huge point. But I think of the experience of students, and Micah, my son, again, has just started this fall in his own theological studies, and he already knows, he's been on the campus of Regent College for 2 months, he already knows, I don't want to miss Intro to Preaching with Daryl Johnson, do I? I say, even if you never preach a single sermon, don't miss Introduction to Preaching with Daryl Johnson. Even if you never preach. Now, you're going to preach. But the whole experience of taking preaching from Daryl will be indeed an experience of soul formation. Why should it not be? And so my thesis, the classroom with the library and those activities that are complementary to the classroom, study, learning at the desk, that these are a venue for soul formation. But now we need to ask, how can this be the case? We have all known the experience of being in a classroom where there was certainly no transformation happening. So we need to ask, how can the classroom itself, the process of teaching and learning, how can it, to go to my prayer of yesterday evening, how can it illumine the mind, rekindle the heart, and strengthen the will? And maybe indeed that should be the goal. How can it illumine the mind, rekindle the heart, and strengthen the will? First, there's no substitute for passion. Teaching faculty new teaching techniques is never a substitute for passion. Why do I reference Bruce Waltke, Albert Kramer, Gordon Fee even, Robert Weber? I reference individuals who evidenced in their teaching an engagement of both heart and mind, that the power of teaching is found precisely in the capacity to foster understanding, but to do so in a manner that is attentive to the contours of the heart. Good teachers teach with passion, conviction, enthusiasm, and now I'll use the word from last night, they teach with joy. Yes, with joy. They bring a deep engagement that reflects not merely their academic research and vigor, but also, it is both, their heartfelt passion for the topic and its implications. They teach with passion because what they're teaching matters, and it matters deeply to them. Inevitably, I will find my students saying to me, "But don't you think, Dr. Smith, that you're overstating your case on something?" And I'm thinking, no, this is terribly important. How can I possibly be overstating my case? And their point is well taken. There's a humor, there's a glint in their eye, but this matters to me. They have a conviction, these professors do, and a passion about their theme and their topic. And here's the rub. They have been deeply shaped by this very same reality. The reason why Bruce Waltke teaching the Psalms was such a powerful experience was that we realized as he walked around these Psalms that he hadn't just walked around them, he had walked through them. He had been deeply shaped by them. He spoke of them as one whose deep passions had been shaped by the Psalms. Our lectures on the book of Philippians, are deeply shaped by our conviction of what it says in the book of Philippians. Those who teach systematic theology and who teach Christology, those, and I've done it, I've taught the six classic Christological heresies, and I've taught them with a certain passion because I want them to see that every one of these heresies is a threat to their soul and why it is a threat to their soul. But also, may we teach Christology as those who live in union not with the Christological principle, but who live in dynamic union with the living and ascended Christ. I teach a course on spiritual discernment. I teach another course entitled Conversion and Transformation. And I teach a third course at Regent called The Meaning of the Sacraments. And the students in these courses know that I think every other course is secondary and incidental. No, I don't tell them that. But they know this, that these courses, in my estimation, are crucial to their own formation. Not the courses, but the topic. And I also think this, that those who teach with passion teach not with anger, but with humor. They teach not with anger, but with humor. That the whole experience of learning is marked by joy, so that we enjoy learning from them. By this, I do not mean that they tell jokes. That would be a waste of time. But rather that they appreciate the humor of the human situation, of the human predicament. They're not overly taken by themselves. They're taken by their topic, but not by themselves. They take their topic seriously, but they aren't necessarily overly impressed with themselves. Secondly, teaching for transformation emphasizes quality and depth over against quantity. We tend to think that more is better when it comes to academics. Long assignments, pages and pages of readings, and the more that you've done, the more impressed you're supposed to be with the length of the project, the length of the work. I mentioned John Webster's book on holiness, and part of the reason why I'm just so impressed by it is that it's so short. It's less than 100 pages long. Part of its brilliance is its conciseness. How many times do I need to tell students I'm not impressed by numbers of pages in this assignment, but that you are, to quote John Stott, clear and concise? As in all things, quality is more valuable than quantity. Quantity matters. If you want to get 3 credits for a course I teach on the meaning of the sacraments, you're going to have to read a lot. You're going to have to go through enough of the literature so that you are informed enough to be able to participate in the conversations we have in class. In my course on discernment, are you ready for it? You're going to have to read Origen and Bernard and Julian of Norwich and Jonathan Edwards and Ignatius Loyola and John Wesley. It will involve substantive reading. Books are a huge gift to us. Why would anybody ever complain that they have to read so much? Oh, that they don't realize the time will come when you will ache for time to be able to read. Embrace now the opportunity that you have to spend time in the library when nobody's knocking on your door. We never need to apologize for giving them reading assignments. But let's not confuse speed reading with wisdom. Both Ignatius Loyola and Jonathan Edwards have segments in their writings when they speak of knowledge that nourishes the soul, an appreciation of truth that runs deep into the marrow of their bones. And for this, we need to view study not as a race, not as an accumulation of knowledge, but as rather as a walk, as a pilgrimage. Even where through the study and conversation, and reflection, and prayer, we grow in wisdom. That is, I can't tell you how many hours it's going to take for you to read this piece, because it's you, and you will need to read it at a pace that you can absorb it. What is most helpful, I should ask? A course where you read the entire Old Testament, or a course where you are asked to read Amos 4 times, but each time to read it with a different set of lenses, with a different set of questions? Is it more profitable to read a lot or to read a little deeply? And perhaps that's a false question. Perhaps it's not either or. But you get my point. Perhaps we need to give fewer assignments, but assignments that are done more diligently, more thoroughly, with more attention to the heart, more attention to the deeper questions that shape our understanding and our practice. Thirdly, we also need to give attention to the spaces where teaching happens. Space matters because we are embodied souls. The spaces of learning matters. I've just come from Romania, And in both of the campuses I visited, the Baptist school in Bucharest and the Pentecostal school in Timisoara. And 3 weeks ago, I was in the Philippines and I visited three seminaries: Biblical Seminary of the Philippines, Asian Theological Seminary, Alliance Graduate School. And in every one of those visits, I always visit classrooms. And I can tell that my host is always wondering, why are we visiting classrooms? They can understand if I want to visit the library, but classrooms, they think, you know, classrooms are classrooms are classroom. I want to say no. The classroom is actually the pivot where all of this happens. It is the heart of what an academic institution is all about. We are a teaching, learning community. This is why we've gathered. Yes, of course I visit the chapel. I want to see where they worship. Yes, of course I visit the library. And I also walk the grounds, and I visit the gardens, and then I go to the residences. And I also visit the offices of the faculty, and I compare them with the very nice offices of the senior administration. But the classrooms are what we are here for, and I ask this: is this classroom a space where learning for transformation can happen? And here's what I look for: natural light, lots of it, a space infused by an abundance of light. I look for a space in which there is no clutter, nothing extraneous, no sense in which one corner of the room has been used for storage. You would never do that in your own living room. Why would you do it for students in a classroom? That this space has no clutter, nothing extra, everything towards the end. I look for spaces that are characterized by beauty. Referencing William Morris, the great genius of the arts and crafts movement, where everything must be both useful and beautiful. Think of both beauty and function. I look for fresh paint on the walls, a lecture podium that isn't just a music stand, but wood with beauty as well as with functionality. That is, I say, transformation happens where people are recognized as being embodied souls. And then fourthly, of course, perhaps the bottom line, that teaching for transformation is rooted by the fact that the people who are doing the teaching care. They are individuals of deep compassion. They care about and for their students. Their students matter to them. They respect their students. They respect the journey of their students and where they are in their own growth and understanding and in wisdom. Quite literally, they love their students, and thus they teach not the discipline, but they teach the student. They welcome the student, to use the language that was spoken of yesterday. And thus I say this as I conclude, and by the way, as was referenced yesterday, we're going to give some time for comments, observations, and questions after this. So if you've been thinking about where you want to go in Rome tomorrow, you haven't been thinking about your question. But if you've been thinking about a question or observation, a time will be given for you to comment. What all of this means, of course, is that the classroom is a venue for soul formation only if we recognize the following: that nothing is so crucial to all of this as the teacher. Nothing matters in theological education so much as the faculty, the women and the men who are at the front of the class, who bring the lectures, who enable the conversations. If you want transformation to happen in and through the classroom, then you need to recruit and develop and care for faculty who become the actual embodiment of the vision of your theological school. Women and men of wisdom and spiritual maturity. Women and men of fundamental kindness and generosity. They care for their students. Women and men of passion for their discipline. They approach their discipline with passion and conviction, and it's evident in the interviews before they come. Women and men of community, faculty and staff, who become together a living embodiment of the call to live in unity, to love each other as Christ has loved us. The faculty are the example, both in and outside of the classroom. They are those who, more than anyone else, signal what you value, what is important to this college or seminary. Yet having said that, I do believe it begins with us, those of us who are involved in academic leadership. Do we, in our own lives and in our own commitments, demonstrate an integration of heart and mind in our own soul formation? Are we students? Do the students see us in the library and realize that we move from the chapel to the library back to the chapel? Do they see in us that our own studies have been informed by our worship and that our worship has been deeply informed by the grace of good scholarship? It seems to me that we need rectors and principals and school presidents who are deeply committed to the academic process, who believe in the classroom, who recognize its value for the inbreaking of the reign of Christ, who, when they walk down the hall and there's a glass window in the door, and they're giving somebody a tour of the campus, and they say, "Look in this window." And then they look in and they say, "You see the teacher and the students? That's the inbreaking of the kingdom that's happening right there. There it is. The inbreaking of the kingdom is happening right there." What I'm getting at is that the inbreaking of the kingdom is not happening just out there. It's happening right there. That indeed, right there, when truth is illuminating minds, when understanding is expanding, we have the inbreaking of the reign of Christ. There, we look in the window and we say, there is the fulfillment of the Great Commission. We are so wont to think that the fulfillment of the Great Commission happens through evangelism out there, and they're being trained to fulfill the Great Commission. And I want to say, no, yes, but no. That is the fulfillment of the Great Commission. That's why we have these theological schools, so that the Great Commission can be fulfilled right there in its very venue, on its very site. And then more than that, that as presidents and rectors and principals, we recruit faculty who share this vision with us for an academic process that is oriented towards and enables spiritual formation, soul formation. And that we have principals and rectors and presidents who recognize that classrooms are terribly important spaces and give as much attention to the quality of that space as to the quality of the office in which they're going to work. I'll stop there and see if you have questions, comments, observations, complaints, queries, anything you'd like to add. We've got about 20 minutes. And I would welcome comments and questions from last night. And I don't mean, this is not a Q&A, as they say, question and answer time. You ask the question and I have the answer. Spare us all. But rather, I'm happy to comment further on something I said that I can clarify. Or perhaps you have a comment that you want to say in addition. I had 6 points, you think I needed a 7th point at some point, and I welcome that. And I realize that also, we probably disagree on some things, and that's good as well. Please. Don't blame the Germans for that, but yes, I understand.
That means that on the Sunday, the pastor should stand in the church in the pulpit and preach, but then if he's a university teacher, then on Monday or Tuesday, he should leave God outside. And there is a complete dichotomy between those things. And some years ago, I wrote a short piece on that in our college paper, because I don't believe in that style, and I've been working as a missionary in Kenya where that kind of thinking doesn't happen.
It's false, yes.
So I wrote that there should be just a short step between the teaching desk on Monday and the pulpit in church on Sunday. And I thought it was a rather good thought, almost brilliant. Then, a while ago, I was studying Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and I was interested in how he was his pastoral teaching and training and formation. And then, unfortunately, I found the really brilliant thought. And that was expressed by him roughly in 1936-37. And I found it in one of those very thick German volumes, illegal theological training, hidden on some page. Just a piece of three or four pages. And you quoted a lot of other people, so if you talk about these things another time, perhaps you could add that quotation, because there he stressed that these three things should be connected. The pulpit, where the pastor is preaching, and the desk where he's teaching, and also he was supposedly praying. Kneeling.
No,
praying.
Wow, marvelous.
So he could presuppose
marvelous.
It that German pastors were
marvelous.
Kneeling.
Yes.
So those three things equally.
Well said. Mm. And I just amen to all of that. What's encouraging to me to see the Chronicle for Higher Education, which is an American publication, about 2 years ago, did a piece on anger in the academy. And it made the observation that anger infuses the academy and that it creates poor teaching. That when you teach out of anger, you draw students, but it actually does not foster good teaching and learning. And the realization that what's happening emotionally in the classroom is not incidental. And so what sustains our teaching will be joy or anger. And the realization that there's no kind of objectivity. And I think that's going to open the window to asking about faith questions in the academy. Inevitably, it opens it up as soon as we discuss both heart and mind. But thank you very much for that comment. And indeed, I should quote him. Point taken. Please, at the back.
Well, thank you again for another tremendously helpful presentation. I wonder if you could say a word about the combination of passion and academic balance. I'm very struck by your emphasis upon passion, and I've drawn to it tremendously. I wonder, is there any tension between the urge to be passionate teachers and communicators and the need for academic and even theological balance? Just to give you one example, I sometimes get concerned that those who teach, for example, in areas of economic and political justice, they might be very, very passionate about a particular point of view, and they seek to communicate that point of view with passion, but in the process, perhaps they risk failing their students in not giving them variety of perspectives, variety of opinions, and I wonder in terms of soul formation, whether you feel that this capacity for balance and understanding a variety of viewpoints needs to supplement that emphasis upon passion.
Last night I phoned my wife after the session and wished her good night. It wasn't good night for her, but it was for me. And she asked how my session had gone. And I said, I think it went well, but not very well. And she says, why don't you think it went very well? And I said, well, I got rather carried away on the radical hospitality point. Oh, she says, how can you get carried away on that? Well, Joella, I did this whole thing about the Lord's Supper and open communion, and I shouldn't have gone there. And then she asked me this question, did you leave your notes? I had to say, yes, Joella, I left my notes. Her point to me was, you should have stuck with your notes. Now, maybe you all think it was fine, but I actually saw that as actually my passion took me away from the discipline of what I was called to do. And so I actually, however, quite apart from what it meant for all of you, I actually think it was a distraction to what I did last night. It's something I wish I hadn't done. And if God brings good out of that, good, but I think it distracted me. A few years ago, we hired a professor of Old Testament at Regent College, and one of the ones that we were most interested in having as a candidate was somebody who was deeply concerned with how the prophets are being read by the poor and the marginalized in the United States, especially in immigrant communities. But what we realized was that this person who was candidating was very angry at the church for its neglect of the poor, and that this anger came through again and again in the guest lectures that he was bringing. And that he really had only one way to read the book of the prophets. He missed the prophetic literature. He missed the whole orb. He missed even the deep joy. He missed the comfort my people. And so that somehow his passion for one thing literally distorted his capacity to see the whole. And that somehow, sometimes our passions can distort our thinking rather than enable us to do good thinking. There's also no substitute for patience, compassion, moving slowly but surely. I think of Jim Packer. I heard him give a lecture on the Trinity a number of years ago. And he gave the lecture, as good as anybody can lecture on the Trinity. And then a student asked the question. And I thought to myself, anybody who's read Packer knows the answer to that question. And actually, anybody who heard the lecture, she must not have been listening, because she wouldn't have asked that, because he answered that two or three times in the lecture. So what does Packer do? Does he say, excuse me, I already answered that question? No. With deep compassion, He just went through it slowly again. I thought, how many thousands of times has he explained that very point? But he just went through it again for her. He just answered for her. She could have been the only person in the room as he explained it yet one more time for her. And it was his deep passion, but it didn't keep him from the slow, deliberate, patient, compassionate articulation of what mattered to him so much. So that somehow he didn't... Our compassion should not derail us from the academic discipline that we're at, but also it should not derail us from serving the needs of the students to whom we are called. So some responses, a couple of responses there, two or three points. A legitimate point, very important question. Please.
I would also like to make a comment, and perhaps that's another situation which you could add to your list. When the first rector of the Utrecht University in the Netherlands, which was founded in the Reformation time, where the Reformation was somewhat later, and it was founded in 1634, when the first lecture, first rector had the opening speech within the whole academic community. And the speech was about the Pietate cum scientia coniungenta, about piety, godliness, which needs to be connected with scholarly work,
yes.
Academic work.
Yes.
And then the stress was not so much, well, these are very separate entities, and it's somewhat artificial to connect them, but nevertheless, we need to do it. No. Both is internally connected,
yes.
If rightly understood.
Yes.
And not only the theology, the whole enterprise,
yes.
Of academic,
yes.
Learning is connected to spiritual formation, as,
yes.
We call it today.
Yeah.
And vice versa. And it was a very flourishing university. And there was from that center in Utrecht a free pietistic movement started in the Netherlands, which later had connection to pietism in Germany, first reformed pietism but also Lutheran pietism, and it started within the academics. But from that sense of both belongs together.
Mm-hmm. Great, I'm glad we could celebrate German rationalism and German piety. This is good. Please.
I love your comment that the classroom can be a place where the kingdom breaks in and you see it. Sometimes you see the lights come on. You also have those students that don't seem to be actively engaged in the classroom. And many of my students still have this student-professor gap in their mind that is huge. One of the things I found reaches some of those students is when I have them into my home. When they can fellowship with me outside of the classroom, somehow that breaks down barriers. And I find there's actually some thought life going on in some of these students' minds. It's just the barrier between them and me. The distance is so
huge
that I need to find outside of classroom settings to start to bridge that gap.
Point well taken. I mean, sometimes our classes are too large where we can't have all of our students over, but sometimes we can have them over in small groups. And we may not get to know them personally, but we give them the capacity to show, to demonstrate that we care about them and have them over for coffee or refreshments. Also, though, think about this, that you're not... If I am trying to think of another... I realize I'm on this side of the ocean and that baseball... is strange activity. I'm trying to think of another sport that I can illustrate. I'm feeling right now a certain pain that the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, that us Canadians, we lost out to the Germans, bless your hearts, and that that's going to be held in Germany. We should have had that, don't you think?
No.
No? We needed it more than you did. But anyways, I'm going to use a baseball metaphor. I'm going to use a baseball metaphor because I just can't think of one from another... from football, I guess I should say. But, no, now they play American football in London. But, typically, in baseball, an inexperienced player tries to hit a home run every time he or she comes up to bat, that this is the ideal. And do you know what I mean by hitting a home run? It means you get a point gets scored on one swing of the bat. But that in actual fact, the great teams use another image. We're not trying to hit a home run, we're just trying to advance the runner. We're just trying to get on base. And I wonder sometimes if in our lecturing, we're always trying to hit a home run. You're going to experience extraordinary, deep transformation right now. And then when we come to the door afterwards and I'm greeting you, I'll say, my goodness, these are transformed students. They took my course on Christology, and they've all now been transformed by Christ. And we're asking sometimes too much of the moment. Could it be that sometimes all we're doing is planting seeds? And yes, they're at the back, and their arms are crossed, and we're thinking they're not really listening here. But seeds are being planted. Some little opening that we can't see, it's just being planted. And somebody else teaching the book of Romans will now water that seed. And somebody else teaching the course on preaching will start to water it even more. So that every time we have a class, even if I have a group this size, I feel that for some of you, I'm planting. For some of you, I'm watering. Perhaps some of you, perhaps I'm about ready to have an altar call. We're going to have a harvest here, whatever it happens to be. I'm a revivalist. I can do this too. But I think you get my point, that let's just realize that our students are at different points in their own growth. They're not all at the same stage of their lives. Even in small classes, they're not all the same point at their Christian pilgrimage. And that sometimes all we're doing is planting. And that's okay. God, I don't think, is necessarily in a big hurry. Now, you may be thinking, unfortunately, they're scheduled to graduate this year, and they hope to be pastors next year. And I realize that potential tension, and then maybe we need to say they need to slow down. Please.
Excuse me, could this be the last one?
No, I don't think. No. Sure, the last one.
You pointed out in your presentation that academic effort supports soul formation. Where is the difference to non-theological academic effort? Does it also create some kind of formation? And how can theologians avoid wrong formation of the soul? I'm thinking of rationalism, I'm thinking of movements, of religious movements, ideologies, and all the rest of it. I mean, there must be some kind of formation there too. Is there not a danger for theologians also to get into a wrong rut?
Certainly. Is it possible for theologians to get in a wrong rut? I use the line that we teach theology as those who stand within the great tradition, our creedal and spiritual heritage. And I would say that that's the case whether I'm teaching in a theological school or in a secular university. But I can actually speak of university courses. When I think of the university courses that I took at a Marxist-Leninist university, it seems so archaic right now, but we had two of them in Canada, Simon Fraser University and the University of Regina, heavily influenced by Marxist-Leninism in the 1970s. It seems almost humorous. My sons look at me and tugging, when was this? I said, it's just not that long ago. I think of the professor I had for Russian literature on Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Chekhov. And I've not been the same since. And he never was explicit, but it was clear that his own Russian orthodoxy was just an unavoidable part. It was not explicit, but it was deeply implicit in his teaching. That even there, the teaching that was soul-forming was because the teacher taught with joy, cared deeply about her or his students. Many of the same kind of features and elements were there. But for those of us who are Christian theologians, obviously what we long for is formation within the theological and spiritual heritage of the church. And so that becomes the guiding light implicitly in everything that we teach. It has to be, in my estimation. And he said, I have to stop there. So we will. We are submissive souls to them. Let's pray. O God of all grace, grant us this grace, I pray, that of all the things we've heard this morning, in the presentation lecture, in the questions, comments, that you would highlight for us in our own hearts and minds what it is that we need to hear, understand, and do. We ask this in Christ's name. Amen. Amen.